Please turn off your cell phones. This is a consumption-free zone for the next 20 minutes. I want to give a very brief overview. I will try to keep within 15 minutes. I was hoping I had an hour and a half, but I'll do what I can. Let me start quickly with what is different from State of the World 2004. I was saying to Klaus on the way here that I think I was a little bit naive back then, and that I thought we could change consumption patterns, thinking in economic terms and in social terms, and create this kind of new vision for a post-consumer society. But over these 6 years of really looking at this topic in different ways, and studying corporate responsibility and security and global ecological and social trends, I realized that if we are going to create a sustainable society, a sustainable human civilization, we have to change our very cultures. We have to really live sustainably at the heart. Our social norms have to reinforce it and make it natural to live sustainably. And so let me start with a definition quickly of culture, which is this, the sum of all social processes that make the artificial or the human constructed seem natural. Okay, so social processes mean everything from a lecture to a radio program, a TV show, advertisements, interaction with media like a book, what your teachers tell you, what your parents tell you, a Facebook update, a Twitter tweet. All of these things add up together, all these different social processes, to construct a reality from what is human and make it seem natural, make it like the air we breathe, just invisible to us. So that something like these two meals can be seen from two different human beings as entirely different. One very appetizing, one horrifying. But in another culture, that would be reversed. A plate full of bugs or insects in certain cultures is a delicacy. Sago grubs in New Guinea are a delicacy, even though they don't look very appetizing here. And in fact, in Washington, D.C., with the launch of the U.S. version, I was able to pass around some bowls of chili roasted grasshoppers to make this point a little bit more salient. Unfortunately, customs is a little bit stricter in Europe, so I wasn't able to. But the diet is a great example to make culture clear in our minds, where how we eat, whether with utensils, with chopsticks, with our fingers, when we eat, whether late. I was in Madrid, as Klaus was mentioning, and the normal time to eat is 9, 10 o'clock at night. But even what we eat, from insects to vegetarian food, some cultures have taboos on pig, on cow. So all of this is very shaped by culture. And what is clear today is that at the heart of cultures around the world, increasingly, is consumerism, a pattern in which high consumption lifestyles become normalized, where our well-being, our status, our happiness, all of these are connected directly, correlated directly to how much we consume. Again, in an invisible way. But this is happening from our very childhood. Before we even can speak, we're already being bombarded and shaped by the culture around us. This is an image of a little girl. If you can see her, she's in the top right. You might not be able to see her. She is surrounded by all of her pink toys. Let me be clear, not all of her toys, her pink toys. This is a little Korean girl, and this artist took pictures around the world of little girls and boys because she was interested not in consumption, but in the gender process, the genderification, the pink toys and how that becomes normalized in children. But what's interesting to me is that increasingly, from before we can even speak, that we are surrounded by a cultural reality that reinforces consumerism. This is a little girl in the U.S., notice the princess outfit, which was an intentional, cultivated industry by Disney. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry now, the princess phenomenon. And little boys with their blue toys, of course. That's in Japan, and here's US again. So across cultures, consumerism is deeply embedding itself into our cultures. To the point where our awareness of the natural world, a different reality, is mediated by a whole set of new logos and things that are actually creating a barrier from us and our connection, our dependence on the natural world. So that is really at the heart, where more and more our cultural reality is centered on consumption and consumerism, and the side effects of that cultural shift are not really that visible to us. These are just some of the side effects of consumerism. And to be clear, we often in the environmental community, to our fault, I think, talk about the symptoms rather than the root causes. We've become obsessed with climate change, but that is not the problem. That is a symptom of our consumption patterns, of our huge population, but especially of the population that consumes at such a huge level. So we have, these are just some of the images of that. Ecological, of course, but then there's also the labor issues, traffic, and things like obesity, where today 1.6 billion people are overweight or obese in the world. That's more people that are overweight than are underweight now. And that's causing ill health, that's causing a destruction of our planet, of course, and so on. To put it another way, of course, is the ecological footprint. Many of you have surely seen this, which shows that we are using 1.3 Earth's worth of carrying capacity each year. But I actually like to look at this in a different way, because of course we only have one Earth. So let's look at how many people the Earth could support at different consumption levels. At current consumption levels, that's 5 billion. That's nearly 2 billion fewer people than we have on the planet today. And if everyone consumed at American levels, well, the Earth could only sustain 1.4 billion people. So consumption matters. If we don't shift our consumption patterns, we are slowly going to undermine our Earth's systems so deeply that we won't, that we'll suffer significant ecological decline, and thus will have a ripple effect on human society. So for me, the key point here is that our current consumption patterns are not sustainable. They are driven by and reinforced by our cultural patterns. So if we are truly to create a sustainable society, if we are truly to thrive long into the future, we'll need to transform our cultures, making it feel as natural to live sustainably, as living as consumers feels today. So let me break that down for a second. The idea that we get our status and our well-being from buying new things, from having high consumption lifestyles, the idea that when I pull out my new iPhone, people look and say, oh, wow, that's great. What kind of apps did you get for it? Instead of when I pull out my 10-year-old cell phone, people say, wow, that's great. How are you able to maintain that cell phone? Or when I drive up to a place in my new SUV, people look, oh, that's good. Versus if I live without a car. This is the goal, to make the most sexy man on the block the one who lives without a car, not the one with the biggest sports car. So there will be a whole difference in cultural norms, a deep shift in what is reinforced by our surrounding communities and what is seen as a taboo. And to be very clear, I am talking about transforming cultures, almost what you'd call cultural engineering. But that is not something that is new. In fact, over the last 100 years, industries have been aggressively changing cultures, shifting cultural norms in order to sell their products. I'll be briefer than I'd like to be just because of time, but the automobile industry has done it since the early 1900s, using all different societal institutions, not just marketing, but changing curriculums in school in order to get children to learn from a very young age that the street is for the car and the car only and not for playing or walking. They worked with police forces in order to fine and arrest jaywalkers, people who cross the street illegally. They even bought up in some cities the public transportation systems and dismantled them in order to make the car the only option. And you can see that in the fast food industry. As another example, in the early 1900s, the burger, the hamburger, was seen as a food for the poor, as an unsafe and unsanitary food, but with a strategic use of many different tools, cultural tools, including marketing. Now, the fast food industry, of all fast food restaurants, 50% in the United States are burger joints, and it's the American meal. In fact, just McDonald's has 10,000 restaurants. This is the map of all the McDonald's in the United States. But of course, this change in dietary norms does not come without significant side effects. McDonald's, of course, has brought ecological damage and many health ramifications in the process. And one last industry that's known for this is the pet industry, which literally has in its strategy papers the goal of humanizing pets, making them our parts of our families, right? So that we'll pay more for food, that we'll put them in clothes, that we'll spend a lot of money on veterinarian services, and so forth. So what we need to do is use these same strategies much deeper as the environmental community to transform cultural norms, to shift cultures. And so not just policy or technologies like we often try to lean on, but really using the six key societal institutions to make this cultural transformation: education and business, government and the media, social movements and traditions can all be harnessed in order to change cultures, to shift cultures away from consumerism and towards sustainability. I'm not going to talk about all six institutions, but I'll give a few examples from some of them just to kind of whet your appetite for the report. Education, I think skip because we have an expert who knows much more. But in very brief, every aspect of education, from the walk to school, to the school meal, to the classroom, to even school gardens, can all be harnessed to teach children from babyhood or childhood on that they are dependent on a living earth system, and that creating values and norms from childhood to live a sustainable life. Business is an interesting one where there's a lot of effort, of course, in corporate responsibility and changing corporate cultures from within. But I think parallel to that is a very powerful tool of social enterprise, right? These businesses are transforming the very understanding of what the mission of business is, which in our cultures is maximizing profit. But that is a cultural norm. The mission of business can evolve and can be pushed to evolve through things like social enterprises, which for them, the mission of business is to maximize social benefit, right? So this is just one example of a restaurant in Thailand, which was started during the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and Thailand was one of the worst sufferers of this. And an entrepreneur set up this restaurant in order to confront cultural norms, stimulate a conversation about safe sex, about condom usage, and really, in a way that was funny and hip and really challenged the restaurant goers to really think about this. Literally, when you walk into the restaurant, there's condoms everywhere. There's bowls of condoms at the front where instead of taking a mint when you leave, it's you have condoms there. They even sponsored a Miss Condom instead of a Miss America or a Miss Universe, thank you, in order to really just bring that out there in all different ways. And it worked. It really helped to open up this topic and break the taboo around talking about safe sex. And that was one of the key tools used to really curb the growth of the AIDS epidemic in Thailand. And the most interesting thing going on now is the institutionalization of social enterprises. The B Corporation, for example, is a way to create a corporate charter that locks in the social mission so that even if the CEO changes or even if the company is bought up by another company, the social mission is locked into the corporate charter so that it's locked into a different mission. just as many businesses say, well, we'd like to be more responsible, but it's our, you know, we're locked in by our shareholders to maximizing growth. This B Corporation charter locks them into maximizing social benefit. Government I'll also skip, but there's many interesting things going on, from choice editing, where we actually try to shape behind the scenes citizens' choices in the most sustainable ways, to even things like Ecuador incorporating Earth's rights into the rights for the Earth into their constitution. One interesting one I think is fascinating is that of marketing and the media. Marketing, in my opinion, is one of the most powerful tools in stimulating consumerism and high levels of consumption. In fact, just in 2008 alone, $643 billion, were spent on marketing worldwide. That's 1% of the gross world product to stimulate consumption. But it also is a very powerful tool if it were harnessed for something else. So social marketing can be just as effective in stimulating sustainable lifestyles or reduced consumption. This is an image of the Matrix, which actually, since it's a nice large audience, how many of you have seen the Matrix? Raise your hand. Too few. So you all have a homework assignment tonight. It's free on the internet. Let's see, one more question. How many of you have seen The Matrix? All right, see, so all of you have, all of you have raised this hand and seen Matrix. You should definitely see The Matrix, because you'll find it very funny. They play off that movie to challenge the idea of corporate factory farming, right? So Leo, the pig, is woken up by Mufius and Chickadee to the fact that he's actually not in a bucolic farm like he thinks, but in a factory farm, and they become freedom fighters fighting against the factory farm model. And it's very funny, but the point is that it uses a very strong story, an interactive kind of engaging story, to get people thinking about factory farming. You know, most organizations send out a video of the horrible conditions in a factory farm, which few people want to look at, and they want to hide that because they don't want to believe that that's what's happening to the meat that they're eating. But this is a story. It's fun. It's engaging, and it pulls people in to this topic in a way that actually makes them act and think. And the exciting thing is with all the different internet tools now, for just a small investment, this had, $50,000 was the entire budget. It reached 5 million people, which is, if you look at return on investment in traditional advertising, it was 10 times more effective as a normal ad. So there's a real power in social marketing that can be used. I'll skip film, but there's a really great storytelling going on with things like Avatar and WALL-E that are really kind of challenging ideas. Social movements are very powerful tool too, but I'll skip it, and I hope someone asks in the Q&A if they'd like. And the last example I'd give is that of traditions, where religious communities, the elders, rituals, and others can all be used to really challenge cultural norms and pull them in towards a more sustainable path. One specific example of that is that of the rite of death. We all will die, and that's something that we often hate to think about, but it is true and inevitable, and unfortunately right now it often is an ecological nightmare. In the U.S., 3.2 million liters of embalming fluid are used every year. Most of that is formaldehyde, a toxic carcinogen that goes straight into the ground and into groundwater in some cases. We use concrete and tons of wood and metal to create coffins. It's very damaging, but it doesn't have to be that way. It could be where the body is actually returned to the earth and part of the natural cycle, so that not only would there be no waste like we're doing now, but the whole process of burying a body could help create new parklands and new forest lands. And in the process, we would transform our understanding of death. Instead of reinforcing the idea that we're separate from nature, that we're trying to prevent the decay process, we would see ourselves as part of nature. And it would reinforce this mythology and this understanding that we are part of the planet, and that would have a longer term, deeper cultural impact on us. So before I close, I do want to just ask one question, and I'll answer it myself, but I would love to debate on this. But which path are we on? Are we going down the road of the Easter Islanders or the Tocopians? For those of you who aren't familiar with either, Easter Island and Tocopia are both islands far removed from any neighbors. And while Easter Island followed a cultural path that was high in consumption and over denuded its natural ecosystem limits and led to the very rapid collapse of its civilization. It grew up to 10,000 people, and by the modern times, it had collapsed down to just over 2,000 people because they had deforested their land to the point where they could not even sustain their population. But the Tocopians recognized their ecological limits, started to feel the strain, but made dramatic cultural changes. They slaughtered all their livestock. They used to eat a lot of pigs. They removed all the pigs and ate lower on the food chain. They created new family planning norms so that only the firstborn child could reproduce, so that they were able to stabilize their population at 1,200 and maintain themselves on the limit of their ecosystems. So that is a key thing that we have to recognize, that technologies will not save us alone. They'll be an important part. I don't want to create enemies. but if we don't change our cultural norms, that is not going to be enough. And in fact, the answer is, I think we are, you know, on the Easter Island path because we are not thinking in deep-seated cultural changes. Instead, we're thinking still in this idea of what the Mayans did when they were faced with a changing climate, which was to, instead of changing the way they lived, they increased sacrifices to the gods. They increased more ritual, the same cultural patterns that had gotten them into the problems, they accelerated. And we, I think, are doing the same thing, thinking that technology will get us out of this problem, where if we build carbon capture and sequestration tools, that will allow us to continue to consume as much electricity as we're using. But it's not going to be the case, not with 6.9 billion people and another 2 billion people on the way. We have to start curbing down our consumption levels significantly and rapidly. And the only way to do that is to shift our cultures, not just to try to get people as individuals to change their consumption, but totally transform cultural norms so that living sustainably becomes natural rather than living as a consumer. And the last very quick point I'll make here is what I would call the essential role of cultural pioneers, individuals who recognize that we are close to an ecological shift and that this will not be in humanity's interest, that this will lead to sheer social chaos and a really bad future. And for people who recognize that and can see the cultural systems around them and take a pioneering role in shifting those cultures, to take on an institution that they have influence over, whether they're a teacher and have influence over the educational system, or a policymaker, or a business entrepreneur, or a priest and has a parish and challenge his parish about the ideas of consumption and simple living. All of these individuals who are moving beyond just changing their own consumption patterns to truly transforming cultures will be essential in this process of shifting us to a culture of sustainability. So let me stop there, and thank you very much.